Terry, you mentioned earlier Montreal, which was 1976, your first Olympic Games. What sort of preparation did you go through then? Were you in a camp beforehand, or did you just roll up, as you mentioned before, in Montreal?
Well, we had a bit of a camp here in Perth before we went to Pakistan. We actually went to Pakistan in the very early part of 1975, and then went to the World Cup following that. And Pakistan was a real eye-opener. We'd never been. And this was my first international tour, and when I say we, quite a few of us were in that boat. We went across into Pakistan, went through a lot of the back areas of Pakistan, which was just an unbelievable hockey country and had a culture of playing the sport where, they were just unbelievably good, and they had lots of them who could play really, really well, and they could run at 100 mile an hour in one direction and turn at right angles while we kept running into the wall. You know, they were just unbelievably good, and they played on clay, and so they could... we were all used to playing on grass, but they played a lot of their hockey on the clay surface, and we played a few games in that type of environment, but mainly in grass. But we experienced, you know, a whole change in the way that we went about what we did as a game, playing in Pakistan, and I think that was one of the best things we ever did, to be quite honest, in that era, was to get away. And actually, when I was involved with the Institute, we in the early days, we wanted to go to Pakistan and into India, because we felt that was a, if you want to call it hardship, it was a hardship that you had to learn to live with and still perform on a daily basis. And it was the lifeblood of a lot of people in those countries. Hockey was a big game, it was a big sport, and so to play in front of big crowds, as it were, possible to do in the early days when you played internationally. You could play in front of 50,000-60,000 without too much trouble. And a lot of things change, most notably their ability to stick with it at the highest level, and so their level of performance dropped away, and so did the crowds. It was a direct correlation there over the period that I was involved. But it was a very good experience. So we went to Pakistan. We went right around Pakistan to places like Shikarpur and Sagoda. The names still stick in my mind, as well as the Multans and the Lahores and the Karachis, and further up to Islamabad and so on. So it was a great experience for a bunch of young guys. And many of the stories that when we get together nowadays, and when we do talk, it takes us back into that part of our lives. Not so much on the hockey pitch, marginally, but what was going on off it. It was really quite an experience.
So who were the teams that you were playing against in Pakistan?
We just played against Pakistan. Right. We played against regional teams as well as we went around, but it seemed as though it was the same group of players to us that were travelling around on the plane. But it was basically just Pakistan over there. Argentina, I recall, were touring there at the same time, before the World Cup, which was in 1975 in Malaysia, in Kuala Lumpur. It was a very interesting period of time, but it was a really hugely important development period for that group of players, I think, that we had in that team.
So then it was straight on to Montreal after the Pakistan trip?
No, Pakistan, we went to the World Cup in 1975, and then 1976 was the Olympics, and we were still very much, you know, we're teaching or doing whatever our profession allowed us to do, and then we'd get away, we'd leave without pay to go on some of these big events. And of course the Olympics is, I guess, the biggest event you can go to, and certainly the biggest multi-sport event, and is totally different from a World Cup in hockey, because World Cup, of course, is just one sport, and it's all hockey, but when you go to the Olympics, it's just it's a totally different experience. You have a multiple setting in the sport environment. Many of these people are just, they're icons in their own right. At that time, most of those big names stayed inside the village. Today, most of them don't. But At that time, most of them stayed inside the village. So it was really much, very much of a very interesting setup and something very hard to explain. But it certainly gives you a good dose of humility when you're there, because you're sitting alongside a lot of very, very famous people in their sporting environments.
Terry, you went to two Olympics. You were at Los Angeles as well. But squeezed in between Montreal and Los Angeles is, of course, Moscow. And the Australian hockey team didn't compete at Moscow. Is that, perhaps looking back now, a decision that you regret the authorities made? Or what sort of effect did it have on the players?
Well, politics and sport probably don't mix. They never have, they never will, and it didn't then. I mean, we'd made a decision at that point that we would go, and it was left up to us by our government to the team. We were totally in agreement that we would go, and we were training. And I remember just a couple of weeks before we left, we had received all our equipment and all the bits and pieces to go, and then the decision was made to pull the rug under that. And from under the feet of the national team, we had a very good side too. We had a good chance of winning, I think, in 1980, but it wasn't to be. Very, very disappointing, and it's still something that sits, you know, sadly in the memory. But you understand how all these things happen as you get older. You realise that a lot of things are literally out of your hands, and quite often out of the hands of many other people as well. And decisions get made for obscure reasons. But from what I've found out, it wasn't a very sensible reason anyway. That the whole thing happened. It was very much politicised, and my memory of the whole deal was that. The Pakistan piece, sorry, it wasn't Pakistan, it was Afghanistan, I think, was invaded theoretically by Russia. And I remember we had some people in Pakistan that we spoke to when we left there one time. We heard that this big invasion had taken place, and we spoke to them, and they were pretty good friends over a period of years that we had at that time. And they said, look, there's nothing different that's going on. It was just fairly highly politicised, but that's what happens. I mean, I guess politics is a strange animal. I've never understood it and don't pretend to, but it certainly changes the way people behave.
Now, moving on from that, you also suffered something of a serious knee injury, and perhaps at a time when why medicine had decided that they could fix those problems, they haven't quite figured out exactly how they were going to fix these problems.
Yeah, well, I did an ACL. I was playing. I still remember it vividly, playing against Ireland at the Perth Stadium, and just trying to turn 180 degrees. Very quickly, and it just didn't work. So I blew the knee out, and they said, "Oh, look, you need to probably have a reconstruction on your knee," which I sort of looked around for and didn't find terribly much information about. And at that time, they were doing this new process, which actually had carbon fibre involved, they'd just sutured here and there and everywhere and joined things up, and I thought, no, I don't think that's a wise thing to do. So I ended up with our physio, Graham Reed. I got a brace that was then very, very, very new on the NBA scene in American basketball, and I managed to get hold of one of these braces and did a huge amount of work strengthening hamstrings particularly, and quads, and using this brace and using an Orthotron, as it was then. I used to use that three or four times a week, and gradually managed to get back to a reasonable place, and managed to get back into the team. And only last year, in actual fact, I decided that I was told that by the time I got to 45, I'd need a complete knee replacement. Now, I was still fairly mobile, had a few problems, but last year I decided to get it completely replaced, so I did that, and that's where I am now. But yeah, I was very lucky to be able to continue to play with an injury like that for such a period of time. But the people around me were the ones who allowed me to, you know, to get the get not the treatment but the work ethic, I guess, and push that pretty hard to make sure that I was able to at least give myself a chance to play.
I do remember you playing in that knee brace. It was like a big pillow, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was fairly large. It was a sort of a concoction of plastic bands and a lot of Velcro strips and so on, and big rubber bands that went across, and pieces underneath to stop the chafing. And so you wore a sleeve underneath and over the top of the brace. So it looked, yeah, it looked a little bit cumbersome, and but it was okay. It held up and stopped that lateral movement of the knee, so you could do most things reasonably well. It still impeded what you could do before, but you just learned what you could and you couldn't do, and you worked appropriately within the boundaries.
Now, your final game for Australia as a player was the 1986 World Cup.
Yep.
Is that right? And for anybody that's interested, there's vision on YouTube of you scoring the winning goal in that particular game. Do you have any your memories of that moment?
I do. I remember it vividly, in actual fact, because I remember JB, Johnny Bestel, scored a corner after that, and we ended up winning 2-1. But the moment was vivid in my mind. I remember the ball coming from the left side on a long corner, as it was in those days. You hit it out from the corner, and it went around the back inside the circle and onto my right side, and the ball basically bounced in front of me. And I remember Ian Taylor, who was the goalkeeper from England, he was an outstanding goalkeeper, and we had all sorts of issues in 1984 at the Olympics. We had a bunch of penalty calls. We had 22 penalty calls or something for the third and fourth playoff game, and we really messed it up, and we probably should have won the gold medal in that year. We didn't, and we didn't win the bronze medal either. And the bronze medal failure was fairly well a Taylor proposition. It was outstanding on the penalty corners, and we weren't so efficient, I don't think. But needless to say, in 86 we had our chance again with Taylor in the net, and so there was a bit of history there. But I remember the ball bobbling, and it was sort of between knee and waist height, and I thought, well, I'm just going to knock this into the corner, but Taylor might get this with an outstretched leg if I sort of hit it down. So I deliberately knocked it into the ground, into the turf, so he'd have to go with his leg, and it would hit the turf and just bounce up into the air, and he couldn't do anything about it because he'd have an outstretched leg. And that's exactly what happened, and it seems slow motion to me still today. But I remember that vividly, and it's really, really slow in my own mind. But I have seen the goal again, obviously, and it happens pretty fast. But it's amazing at what mine can do.
Was that one of your better goal celebrations?
I really don't know. I sort of enjoyed scoring goals. I remember one of the best goal scoring, not a celebration, but I remember hitting a goal and I didn't even bother watching whether it went in or not. I was facing the wrong way, and I just smacked it in and just tucked the stick under my arm and walked back to the centre. But yeah, look, you remember odd things, and not necessarily in the very top competition that you play in, but the camaraderie and the people around you, and the tales that are told, you know, with all of that, I think is one of the major things that keeps you together over a long period of time when you're playing on the international scene. And that was the case. We were really lucky to have a great group of people, both on and off the pitch, within the group, who were really supportive, and yeah, we were fortunate to be successful as well. So it was a great era.
Now, from there, Terry, you moved into coaching. Was that something that you'd thought about before you retired, or and had a plan with, or something you fell into?
Well, I sort of fell into it to a degree. I was teaching, and Richard Aggas was the then national coach, and he was invited to be the head coach of the Australian Institute of Sport, which was set up in Perth. And Dodger, as we knew Richard, Dodger said or asked me if I'd be interested in being a coach in the system, and I was still playing at that point. And I agreed, and I came out of the teaching world, went into the institute in 1984. in Perth, which was its first year, and indeed it was the first decentralised AIS program in Australia. So we went in there and we basically initiated what's now been a long-standing AIS program centralised in Perth. So that was when I started my coaching career, and since then, of course, I finished up in 86, and then I did different Olympic programs with different countries, but I've been to, I don't know, 8 or 9 Olympics, I guess, now, so in different areas of coaching, and you know, I've been lucky. I've coached some really good teams around the world, you know, some really high level teams, and I've really enjoyed it. The experience has been very, very different, and I've seen the game evolve, and I've seen different teams evolve in different ways. But I've been around in it for a long time now, because that started in 84. What are we now? 17. So it's been a fair while. Been a fair while in the professional coaching environment.
So you're currently involved with Malaysia. You first started out there as head coach in 1990?
Yeah, I went to Malaysia in 1990. I coached the Australian junior team in 1989 in a place called Ipoh in Malaysia. And the Malaysians invited me to be the national coach in 1990, which I took up. They hadn't been in the Olympics for a while, and we managed to get them into the Olympics in 1992, and finished up in 1993. Four out of Malaysia came back to Australia, went back into the institute, and then all sorts of things happened. Then I went away and coached in America as a consultant with their women's program. I came back and then coached the Australian national team. Being the head of the AIS and also the Olympic program for 2000, then finished, as I thought, with coaching, went into technology. I was heavily involved in a program called Sports Code, which is just a non-linear editing, as it was known right in the early days, program, which allowed us to get to bits and pieces of video and do analysis. And I was very heavily involved in that, in the coaching side of it, in the development phase of the program. And Donnie Pryor was also involved between the writer, the guy who actually did all the writing of the program, and myself with all the concepts and ideas, I guess. And I went out of coaching after 2000 and went into had been taken over by a group called Sports Tech with Philip Jackson and co. And I did a lot of work around the world, just talking to big sporting organizations about using sports analysis, video sports analysis, with this program. And now it's used, fairly comprehensively around the world, I've got to say. In the NBA, it's used, and Australian football is used comprehensively. It's world football, soccer. It's used by a lot of the big teams now. So, it's been exciting. Then I somehow or other ended up in coaching Holland in 2004, which was a really strange experience, because they had all sorts of internal problems in going into 2000, at the end of 2003, and they asked me to coach their national team for Athens. So they had to qualify for that. I took the role, and we qualified, and I got through. The team got through to Athens, and that was the most bizarre situation of all, because we ended up playing Holland in Holland played Australia in the final. It was really quite amazing. Australia won, so it was a very sad for Holland. But I didn't know which side of the fence to have my feet, so I was sort of it was just a very, very strange moment in my coaching career.
So how does that feel for a coach with the divided loyalty, your employer versus your country?
I just think it's the professional side of things. You just do what you have to do. I mean, I was particularly proud of the Australian side for winning the Olympics. I know how hard it is to win the Olympics. It's just a very, very difficult task. And as a player, never, ever succeeded in doing so. But I think it's a really tough environment. And to Baz, who'd come in after me, and all the players I knew pretty well, they're either just coming into the scene or they're already there from 2000. It was quite an interesting time. Yeah, it's probably not an experience you can talk about easily, but because unless you understand the difference between standing in front of a flag and listening to the national anthem of another country whom you're coaching, and then listening to your own country and the national anthem, that's simplistically what it is. And I mean, in the end, you never ever would walk away and turn your back on the Australian national anthem, and I never have. But equally, I respect totally the national anthems of all countries, but particularly those who I've coached.
So then a move to the States, and you know, we obviously see the USA women have come on leaps and bounds, particularly in the last 3 or 4 years. Do you see that being some of the groundwork that you put in those earlier days coming to fruition?
No, USA is a very different kettle of fish. It's its own style of programming. It's got the best women's programming in the world with reference to colleges. If you can play hockey reasonably well as a female, and you're relatively smart, you can get a college scholarship there, and it's the best program around. It really, really is very, very good. In my view, it doesn't happen for men at all in America, so it's virtually all the women's side. But I went there as a technical director, and I did a lot of work in the development phase and tried to get them to understand a little bit more about the culture of the game and how to play it. I worked at grassroots level through to college level, and obviously was involved with the national program as well, both the women and the men. In actual fact, pretty hard work with the men. I remember going there, and we only had about 25 or 26 players, and we finished up with several hundred, but we did okay with the men. I mean, the men were, I remember having success at beating Argentina and beating Canada and so on and so forth. That was quite an experience. But the women's program was the major one, and there wasn't any doubt that from that side, there's no doubt that we set a huge base network for them.